their wages, as no honourable man would extort them, and other ways, which I for one would scorn to use. The real rate of wage paid at Dickinson's is less than at ours. Upon my word, mother, I wish the old combination laws were in force. It is too bad to find out that fools, ignorant, wayward men like these, just by uniting their weak, silly heads, are to rule over the fortunes of those who bring all the wisdom that knowledge and experience, and often painful thought and anxiety, can give. The next thing will be, indeed we're all but come to it now, that we shall have to go and ask, stand hat in hand, and humbly ask the Secretary of the Spinners' Union to be so kind as to furnish us with labour at their own price. That's what they want. They, who haven't the sense to see that if we don't get a fair share of the profits to compensate us for our wear and tear here in England, we can move off to some other country. And that, what with home and foreign competition, we are none of us likely to make above a fair share, and may be thankful enough if we can get that in an average number of years. Can't you get hands from Ireland? I wouldn't keep these fellows a day. I'd teach them that I was master and could employ what servants I liked. Yes, to be sure I can, and I will too, if they go on long. It will be trouble and expense, and I fear there will be some danger, but I will do it rather than give in. If there is to be all this extra expense, I'm sorry we're giving a dinner just now. So am I. Not because of the expense, but because I shall have much to think about, and many unexpected calls on my time. But we must have had Mr. Horseball, and he does not stay in Milton long. And as for the others, we owe them dinners, and it's all one trouble. He kept on with his restless walk, not speaking any more, but drawing a deep breath from time to time, as if endeavouring to throw off some annoying thought. Fanny asked her mother numerous small questions, all having nothing to do with the subject, which a wiser person would have perceived was occupying her attention. Consequently, she received many short answers. She was not sorry when, at 10 o'clock, the servants filed into prayers. These her mother always read, first reading a chapter. They were now working steadily through the Old Testament. When prayers were ended, and his mother had wished him good night, with that long, steady look of hers which conveyed no expression of the tenderness that was in her heart, but yet had the intensity of a blessing, Mr. Thornton continued his walk. All his business plans had received a check, a sudden pull-up, from this approaching turnout. The forethought of many anxious hours was thrown away, utterly wasted by their insane folly, which would injure themselves even more than him, though no one could set any limit to the mischief they were doing. And these were the men who thought themselves fitted to direct the masters in the disposal of their capital. Hamper had said, only this very day, but if he were ruined by the strike, he would start life again, comforted by the conviction that those who brought it on were in a worse predicament than he himself. For he had head as well as hands, while they had only hands. And if they drove away their market, they could not follow it, nor turn to anything else. But this thought was no consolation to Mr. Thornton. It might be that revenge gave him no pleasure. It might be that he valued the position he had earned with the sweat of his brow, so much that he keenly felt its being endangered by the ignorance or folly of others, so keenly that he had no thoughts to spare for what would be the consequences of their conduct to themselves. He paced up and down, setting his teeth a little now and then. At last it struck 2. The candles were flickering in their sockets. He lighted his own, muttering to himself, "Once for all, they shall know whom they have got to deal with. I can give them a fortnight, no more. If they don't see their madness before the end of that time, I must have hands from Ireland. I believe it's Slickson's doing. Confound him and his dodges. He thought he was overstocked, so he seemed to yield at first when the deputation came to him, and of course he only confirmed them in their folly, as he meant to do. That's where it spread from." Chapter 19. Angel Visits. As angels in some brighter dreams call to the soul when man doth sleep, so some strange thoughts transcend our wonted themes and into glory peep. Henry Vaughan. Mrs. Hale was curiously amused and interested by the idea of the Thornton dinner party. She kept wondering about the details, with something of the simplicity of a little child who wants to have all its anticipated pleasures described beforehand. But the monotonous life led by invalids often makes them like children, inasmuch as they have neither of them any sense of proportion in events, and seem each to believe that the walls and curtains which shut in their world and shut out everything else must of necessity be larger than anything hidden beyond. Besides, Mrs. Hale had had her vanities as a girl, had perhaps unduly felt their mortification when she became a poor clergyman's wife. They had been smothered and kept down, but they were not extinct, and she liked to think of seeing Margaret dressed for a party and discussed what she should wear, with an unsettled anxiety that amused Margaret, who had been more accustomed to society in her one in Harley Street than her mother in 25 years of Helston. "Then you think you shall wear your white silk? Are you sure it will fit? It's nearly a year since Edith was married." "Oh, yes, Mama. Mrs. Murray made it, and it's sure to be right. It may be a straw's breadth shorter or longer waisted, according to my having grown fat or thin, but I don't think I've altered in the least. Hadn't you better let Dixon see it? It may have gone yellow with lying by." "If you like, Mama. But if the worst comes to the worst, I've a very nice pink gauze which Aunt Shaw gave me only 2 or 3 months before Edith was married. That can't have gone yellow." "No, but it may have faded." "Well, then I've a green silk. I feel more as if it was the embarrassment of riches." "I wish I knew what you ought to wear," said Mrs. Hale nervously. Margaret's manner changed instantly. "Shall I go and put them on, one after another, Mama, and then you could see what you liked best? But, yes, perhaps that will be best." So off Margaret went. She was very much inclined to play some pranks when she was dressed up at such an unusual hour, to make her rich white silk balloon out into a cheese, to retreat backwards from her mother as if she were the queen. But when she found that these freaks of hers were regarded as interruptions to the serious business, and as such annoyed her mother, she became grave and sedate. What had possessed the world, her world, to fidget so about her dress, she could not understand. But that very afternoon, on naming her engagement to Bessie Higgins, apropos of the servant that Mrs. Thornton had promised to inquire about, Bessie quite roused up at the intelligence. "Dear, and are you going to dine at Thornton's at Marlborough Mills?" "Yes, Bessie. Why are you so surprised?" "Oh, I dunno, but they visit where are the first folk in Milton." "And you don't think we're quite the first folk in Milton, eh, Bessie?" Bessie's cheeks flushed a little at her thought being thus easily read. "Well," said she, "you see, they're thinking a deal of money here, and I reckon you've not getting much." "No," said Margaret, "that's very true. But we are educated people, and have lived amongst educated people. Is there anything so wonderful in our being asked out to dinner by a man who owns himself inferior to my father by coming to him to be instructed? I don't mean to blame Mr. Thornton. Few draper's assistants, as he was once, could have made themselves what he is." "But can you give dinners back in your small house? Thornton's house is 3 times as big." "Well, I think we could manage to give Mr. Thornton a dinner back, as you call it. Perhaps not in such a large room, nor with so many people. But I don't think we've thought about it at all in that way." "I never thought you'd be dining with Thornton's," repeated Bessie. "Why, the mayor hissel dines there, and the members of Parliament and all. I think I could support the honour of meeting the mayor of Milton." "But them ladies dress so grand," said Bessie, with an anxious look at Margaret's print gown, which her Milton eyes appraised at 7d a yard. Margaret's face dimpled up into a merry laugh. "Thank you, Bessie, for thinking so kindly about my looking nice among all the smart people, but I've plenty of grand gowns. A week ago, I should have said they were far too grand for anything I should ever want again. But as I'm to dine at Mr. Thornton's, and perhaps to meet the mayor, I shall put on my very best gown, you may be sure." "What will you wear?" asked Bessie, somewhat relieved. "White silk," said Margaret, "a gown I had for a cousin's wedding a year ago." "That'll do," said Bessie, falling back in her chair. I should be loath to have you looked down upon. Oh, I'll be fine enough, if that will save me from being looked down upon in Milton. I wish I could see you dressed up, said Bessie. I reckon you're not what folk would call pretty. You've not red and white enough for that. But don't you know, I had dreamt of you long afore ever I seed you. Nonsense, Bessie. Aye, but I did. Your very face, looking with your clear, steadfast eyes out of the darkness, with your hair blown off from your brow, and going out like rays round your forehead, which was just as smooth and as straight as it is now. And you always came to give me strength, which I seemed to gather out of your deep, comforting eyes. And you were dressed in shining raiment, just as you're going to be dressed. So, you see, it was you. Nay, Bessie, said Margaret gently, it was but a dream. And why might not I dream a dream in my affliction as well as others? Didn't not many a one in the Bible? Aye, and see visions too. Why, even my father thinks a deal of dreams. I tell you again, I saw you as plainly coming swiftly towards me with your hair blown back with the very swiftness of the motion, just like the way it grows, a little standing off like, and the white shining dress on you've getting to wear. Let me come and see you in it. I want to see you and touch you, as in very deed you were in my dream. My dear Bessie, it is quite a fancy of yours. Fancy or no fancy, you've come, as I knew you would, when I saw your movement in my dream. And when you hear about me, I reckon I feel easier in my mind, and comforted, just as a fire comforts one on a dreary day. You said it were on the 21st. Please God, I'll come and see you. Oh, Bessie, you may come and welcome, but don't talk so. It really makes me sorry. It does indeed. Then I'll keep it to myself, if I bite my tongue out. Not but what it's true for all that. Margaret was silent. At last she said, Let us talk about it sometimes, if you think it true, but not now. Tell me, has your father turned out? Aye, said Bessie heavily, in a manner very different from that she had spoken in but a minute or two before. He and many another, all hampers men, and many a one besides. The women are as bad as the men in their savageness this time. Food is high, and they mun have food for their childer, I reckon. Suppose Thornton sent them their dinner out. The same money spent on potatoes and meal would keep many a crying babby quiet and hush up its mother's heart for a bit. Don't speak so, said Margaret. You'll make me feel wicked and guilty in going to this dinner. No, said Bessie. Some's pre-elected to sumptuous feasts in purple and fine linen. Maybe you're one on em. Others toil and moil all their lives long, and the very dogs are not pitiful in our days, as they were in the days of Lazarus. But if you ask me to cool your tongue with the tip of my finger, I'll come across the great gulf to you just for the thought of what you've been to me here. Bessie, you're very feverish. I can tell it in the touch of your hand, as well as in what you're saying. It won't be division enough in that awful day that some of us have been beggars here and some of us have been rich. We shall not be judged by that poor accident, but by our faithful following of Christ. Margaret got up and found some water, and soaking her pocket handkerchief in it, she laid the cool wetness on Bessie's forehead and began to chafe the stone-cold feet. Bessie shut her eyes and allowed herself to be soothed. At last she said, You'd have been deaved out of your five wits as well as me if you'd had one body after another coming in to ask for father and staying to tell me each one their tale. Some spoke a deadly hatred and made my blood run cold with the terrible things they said of the masters, but more, being women, kept plaining, plaining, with the tears running down their cheeks and never wiped away nor heeded, of the price of meat, and how their children could na sleep at nights for the hunger. "And do they think the strike will mend this?" asked Margaret. "They say so," replied Bessie. "They do say trade has been good for long, and the masters has made no end of money. How much father doesn't know, but in course the union does. And as is natural, they want their share of the profits now that food is getting dear. And the union says They'll not be doing their duty if they don't make the masters give 'em their share. But masters has gotten the upper hand somehow, and I'm feared they'll keep it now and evermore. It's like the great battle of Armageddon, the way they keep on, grinning and fighting at each other, till even while they fight, they are picked off into the pit. Just then Nicholas Higgins came in. He caught his daughter's last words.
Aye, and I'll fight on too, and I'll get it this time. It'll not take long for to make 'em give in, but they're getting a pretty lot of orders, all under contract, and they'll soon find out they'd better give us our 5% than lose the profit they'll gain, let alone the fine for not fulfilling the contract. Aha, my masters, I know who'll win.
Margaret fancied from his manner that he must have been drinking, not so much from what he said as from the excited way in which he spoke, and she was rather confirmed in this idea by the evident anxiety Bessie showed to hasten her departure. Bessie said to her,
"The 21st, that's Thursday week. I may come and see you dressed for Thornton's, I reckon. What time is your dinner?"
Before Margaret could answer, Higgins broke out.
"Thornton's? Art going to dine at Thornton's? Ask him to give you a bumper to the success of his orders. By the 21st, I reckon he'll be potted in his brains how to get 'em done in time. Tell him there's 700'll come marching into Marlborough Mills the morning after he gives the 5%, and we'll help him through his contract in no time. He'll have 'em all there. My master, Hamper, he's one of the old-fashioned sort. Ne'er meets a man bout an oath or a curse. I should think we were going to die if he spoke me civil. But atter all, his bark's more than his bite, and you may tell him one of his turnouts said so if you like. Eh, but you'll have a lot of prize mill owners at Thornton's. I should like to get a speech of them, when they're a bit inclined to sit still after dinner, and could now run for the life on 'em. I'd tell 'em my mind, I'd speak up again the hard way they're driving on us."
"Goodbye," said Margaret hastily. "Goodbye, Bessie. I shall look to see you on the 21st if you're well enough."
The medicines and treatment which Dr. Donaldson had ordered for Mrs. Hale did her so much good at first that not only she herself, but Margaret began to hope that he might have been mistaken, and that she could recover permanently. As for Mr. Hale, although he had never had an idea of the serious nature of their apprehensions, he triumphed over their fears with an evident relief, which proved how much his glimpse into the nature of them had affected him. Only Dixon croaked forever into Margaret's ear. However, Margaret defied the raven and would hope. They needed this gleam of brightness indoors, for out of doors, even to their uninstructed eyes, there was a gloomy, brooding appearance of discontent. Mr. Hale had his own acquaintances among the working men, and was depressed with their earnestly told tales of suffering and long endurance. They would have scorned to speak of what they had to bear to anyone who might, from his position, have understood it without their words. But here was this man from a distant county, who was perplexed by the workings of the system into the midst of which he was thrown, and each was eager to make him a judge and to bring witness of his own causes for irritation. Then Mr. Hale brought all his budget of grievances and laid it before Mr. Thornton, for him, with his experience as a master, to arrange them and explain their origin, which he always did, on sound economical principles, showing that as trade was conducted, there must always be a waxing and waning of commercial prosperity, and that in the waning, a certain number of masters, as well as of men, must go down into ruin and be no more seen among the ranks of the happy and prosperous. He spoke as if this consequence were so entirely logical that neither employers nor employed had any right to complain if it became their fate. The employer to turn aside from the race he could no longer run, with a bitter sense of incompetency and failure, wounded in the struggle, trampled down by his fellows in their haste to get rich, slighted where he once was honoured, humbly asking for, instead of bestowing, employment with a lordly hand. Of course, speaking so of the fate that as a master might be his own in the fluctuations of commerce, he was not likely to have more sympathy with that of the workmen, who were passed by in the swift, merciless improvement or alteration, who would fain lie down and quietly die out of the world that needed them not. but felt as if they could never rest in their graves for the clinging cries of the beloved and helpless they would leave behind. Who envied the power of the wild bird that can feed her young with her very heart's blood? Margaret's whole soul rose up against him while he reasoned in this way, as if commerce were everything and humanity nothing. She could hardly thank him for the individual kindness which brought him that very evening to offer her, for the delicacy which made him understand that he must offer her privately, every convenience for illness that his own wealth or his mother's foresight had caused them to accumulate in their household, and which, as he learnt from Dr. Donaldson, Mrs. Hale might possibly require. His presence, after the way he had spoken, his bringing before her the doom, which she was vainly trying to persuade herself might yet be averted from her mother, all conspired to set Margaret's teeth on edge as she looked at him and listened to him. What business had he to be the only person, except Dr. Donaldson and Dixon, admitted to the awful secret, which she held shut up in the most dark and sacred recess of her heart, not daring to look at it unless she invoked heavenly strength to bear the sight, that some day soon she should cry aloud for her mother, and no answer would come out of the blank, dumb darkness. Yet he knew all. She saw it in his pitying eyes. She heard it in his grave and tremulous voice. How reconcile those eyes, that voice, with the hard, reasoning, dry, merciless way in which he laid down axioms of trade, and serenely followed them out to their full consequences? The discord jarred upon her inexpressibly, the more because of the gathering woe of which she heard from Bessie. To be sure, Nicholas Higgins, the father, spoke differently. He had been appointed a committee man, and said that he knew secrets of which the exoteric knew nothing. He said this more expressly and particularly on the very day before Mrs. Thornton's dinner party, when Margaret, going in to speak to Bessie, found him arguing the point with Boucher, the neighbour of whom she had frequently heard mention, as by turns exciting Higgins's compassion as an unskilful workman with a large family depending upon him for support, and at other times enraging his more energetic and sanguine neighbour by his want of what the latter called spirit. It was very evident that Higgins was in a passion when Margaret entered. Boucher stood, with both hands on the rather high mantelpiece, swaying himself a little on the support which his arms thus placed gave him, and looking wildly into the fire with a kind of despair that irritated Higgins, even while it went to his heart. Bessie was rocking herself violently backwards and forwards, as was her wont, Margaret knew by this time, when she was agitated. Her sister Mary was tying on her bonnet, in great clumsy bows, as suited her great clumsy fingers, to go to her fustian cutting, blubbering out loud the while, and evidently longing to be away from a scene that distressed her. Margaret came in upon this scene. She stood for a moment at the door. Then, her finger on her lips, she stole to a seat on the squab near Bessie. Nicholas saw her come in, and greeted her with a gruff but not unfriendly nod. Mary hurried out of the house, catching gladly at the open door, and crying aloud when she got away from her father's presence. It was only John Boucher that took no notice, whatever, who came in and who went out. "It's no use, Higgins, who cannot live long as this'un. Who's just sinking away, not for one to meet hersel, but because who cannot stand the sight of the little ones clemming. Aye, clemming. 5 shilling a week may do well enough for thee. We're but 2 mouths to fill, and one on Emma Wench who can welly earn her own meat. But it's clemming to us, and I tell thee plain, if who dies as I'm feared who will afore we're getting the 5%, I'll fling the money back in the master's face and say, be domned to you, be domned to the whole cruel world of you, that could now leave me the best wife that ever bore childer to a man. And look thee, lad, I'll hate thee, and the whole pack of the Union, aye, and chase you through heaven with my hatred. I will, lad, I will, if you're leading me astray in this matter. Thou saidst, Nicholas, on Wednesday se'night, and it's now Tuesday in the 2nd week, but afore a fortnight we'd had the masters coming a-begging to us to take back our work at our own wage, and time's nearly up. And there's our little Jack lying abed, too weak to cry, but just every now and then sobbing up his heart for want of food.
our little Jack, I tell thee, lad, who's never looked up since he were born, and who loves him as if he were her very life, as he is, for I reckon he'll ha' cost me that precious price. Our little Jack, who wakened me each morn with putting his sweet little lips to my great rough foul face, a-seeking a smooth place to kiss, and he lies clemming.
Here the deep sobs choked the poor man, and Nicholas looked up, with eyes brimful of tears, to Margaret, before he could gain courage to speak.
"How doth, man? Thy little Jack shall na clem. I get in brass, and we'll go buy the chap a supper milk and good 4 pounder this very minute. What's mine's thine, sure enough, if thou'st i' want. Only dunnot lose heart, man," continued he, as he fumbled in a teapot for what money he had. "I'll lay you my heart and soul will win for her this. It's but bearing on one more week, and you'll just see the way the masters'll come round, preying on us to come back to our mills. And the union, that's to say I, will take care you've enough for the childer and the missus. So dunnot turn faint-heart and go to the tyrants a-seeking work."
The man turned round at these words, turned round a face so white and gaunt and tear-furrowed and hopeless, but its very calm forced Margaret to weep.
"You know well, but a worse a tyrant than e'er the masters were, says clem to death, and see him a-clem to death, ere you dare go again the union. You know it well, Nicholas, for I your one on em. You may be kind hearts each separate, but once banded together, you've no more pity for a man than a wild hunger-maddened wolf."
Nicholas had his hand on the lock of the door. He stopped and turned round on Boucher, close following.
"So help me God, man alive, if I think not I'm doing best for thee, and for all on us. If I'm going wrong when I think I'm going right, it's their sin who have left me where I am in my ignorance. I ha' thought till my brains ached. Believe me, John, I have. And I say again, there's no help for us but having faith in the union. They'll win the day, see if they dunnot."
Not one word had Margaret or Bessie spoken. They had hardly uttered the sighing that the eyes of each called to the other to bring up from the depths of her heart. At last Bessie said,
"I never thought to hear father call on God again, but you heard him say, 'So help me God.'"
"Yes," said Margaret, "let me bring you what money I can spare. Let me bring you a little food for that poor man's children. Don't let them know it comes from anyone but your father. It will be but little." Bessie lay back without taking any notice of what Margaret said. She did not cry, she only quivered up her breath.
"My heart's drained dry o' tears," she said. "Boucher's been in these days past, a-telling me of his fears and his troubles. He's but a weak kind o' chap, I know, but he's a man for a' that. And though I've been angry many a time afore now, wi' him and his wife, as knew no more nor him how to manage, yet you see all folks isn't wise, yet God lets em live, aye, and gives em someone to love and be loved by, just as good as Solomon. And if sorrow comes to them they love, it hurts em sore as e'er it did Solomon. I can't make it out. Perhaps it's as well such a one as Boucher has the union to see after him, but I'd just like for to see the mean as make the union and put em one by one face to face wi' Boucher. I reckon if they hurt him, they'd tell him, if I cotched em one by one, he might go back and get what he could for his work, even if it weren't so much as they ordered." Margaret sat utterly silent. How was she ever to go away into comfort and forget that man's voice with the tone of unutterable agony, telling more by far than his words of what he had to suffer? She took out her purse. She had not much in it of what she could call her own, but what she had she put into Bessie's hand without speaking.
"Thank you. There's many on em gets no more, and is not so bad off. Leastways does not show it as he does. But father won't let em want, now he knows. You see, Boucher's been pulled down wi' his childer, and her being so cranky, and ah, they could pawn has gone this last 12 month. You're not to think we'd a letting em clem, for all we're a bit pressed ourselves. If neighbours doesn't see after neighbours, I dunno who will."
Bessie seemed almost afraid lest Margaret should think they had not the will, and to a certain degree the power of helping one whom she evidently regarded as having a claim upon them. Besides, she went on, Father is sure and positive the masters must give in within these next few days, that they cannot howl down much longer. But I thank you all the same. I thank you for myself as much as for Boucher, for it just makes my heart warm to you more and more. Bessie seemed much quieter today, but fearfully languid and exhausted. As she finished speaking, she looked so faint and weary that Margaret became alarmed. It's nowt, said Bessie. It's not death yet. I had a fearful night with dreams, or somewhat like dreams, for I were wide awake, and I'm all in a swounding daze today. Only yon poor chap made me alive again. No, it's not death yet, but death is not far off. Aye, cover me up, and I'll maybe sleep, if the cough will let me. Good night, good afternoon, Mappin, I should say, but the light is dim and misty today.
Chapter 20 Men and Gentlemen.
Old and young, boy, let 'em all eat, I have it. Let 'em have 10 tire of teeth apiece, I care not.
Rollo, Duke of Normandy.
Margaret went home so painfully occupied with what she had heard and seen that she hardly knew how to rouse herself up to the duties which awaited her, the necessity for keeping up a constant flow of cheerful conversation for her mother, who, now that she was unable to go out, always looked to Margaret's return from the shortest walk as bringing in some news.
"And can your factory friend come on Thursday to see you dressed?"
"She was so ill I never thought of asking her," said Margaret dolefully.
"Dear, everybody is ill now, I think," said Mrs. Hale, with a little of the jealousy which one invalid is apt to feel of another. "But it must be very sad to be ill in one of those little back streets." Her kindly nature prevailing, and the old Helston habits of thought returning. "It's bad enough here. What could you do for her, Margaret? Mr. Thornton has sent me some of his old port wine since you went out. Would a bottle of that do her good, think you?"
"No, Mama, I don't believe they are very poor. At least they don't speak as if they were. And at any rate, Bessie's illness is consumption. She won't want wine. Perhaps I might take her a little preserve, made of our dear Helston fruit. No, there's another family to whom I should like to give. Oh, Mama, Mama, how am I to dress up in my finery and go off and away to smart parties after the sorrow I have seen today?" exclaimed Margaret, bursting the bounds she had preordained for herself before she came in, and telling her mother of what she had seen and heard at Higgins's cottage. It distressed Mrs. Hale excessively. It made her restlessly irritated till she could do something. She directed Margaret to pick up a basket in the very drawing-room to be sent there and then to the family, and was almost angry with her for saying that it would not signify if it did not go till morning, as she knew Higgins had provided for their immediate wants, and she herself had left money with Bessie. Mrs. Hale called her unfeeling for saying this, and never gave herself breathing time till the basket was sent out of the house. Then she said, "After all, we may have been doing wrong. It was only the last time Mr. Thornton was here that he said those were no true friends who helped to prolong the struggle by assisting the turnouts. And this Boucher man was a turnout, was he not?" The question was referred to Mr. Hale by his wife when he came upstairs, fresh from giving a lesson to Mr. Thornton, which had ended in conversation, as was their wont. Margaret did not care if their gifts had prolonged the strike. She did not think far enough for that, in her present excited state. Mr. Hale listened, and tried to be as calm as a judge. He recalled all that had seemed so clear not half an hour before, as it came out of Mr. Thornton's lips. And then he made an unsatisfactory compromise. His wife and daughter had not only done quite right in this instance, but he did not see for a moment how they could have done otherwise. Nevertheless, as a general rule, it was very true what Mr. Thornton said, that as the strike, if prolonged, must end in the master's bringing hands from a distance, if indeed the final result were not, as it had often been before, the invention of some machine which would diminish the need of hands at all. Why, it was clear enough that the kindest thing was to refuse all help which might bolster them up in their folly. But as to this Boucher, he would go and see him the first thing in the morning, and try and find out what could be done for him. Mr. Hale went the next morning, as he proposed. He did not find Boucher at home, but had a long talk with his wife, promised to ask for an infirmary order for her, and seeing the plenty provided by Mrs. Hale, and somewhat lavishly used by the children, who were masters downstairs in their father's absence, he came back with a more consoling and cheerful account than Margaret had dared to hope for. Indeed, what she had said the night before had prepared her father for so much worse a state of things that by a reaction of his imagination he described all as better than it really was. "But I will go again and see the man himself," said Mr. Hale. "I hardly know as yet how to compare one of these houses with our Helston cottages. I see furniture here which our labourers would never have thought of buying, and food commonly used which they would consider luxuries. Yet for these very families there seems no other resource, now that their weekly wages are stopped, but the pawn shop. One had need to learn a different language and measure by a different standard up here in Milton." Bessie, too, was rather better this day. Still, she was so weak that she seemed to have entirely forgotten her wish to see Margaret dressed, if, indeed, that had not been the feverish desire of a half-delirious state. Margaret could not help comparing this strange dressing of hers, to go where she did not care to be, her heart heavy with various anxieties, with the old merry girlish toilettes that she and Edith had performed scarcely more than a year ago. Her only pleasure now in decking herself out was in thinking that her mother would take delight in seeing her dressed. She blushed when Dixon, throwing the drawing-room door open, made an appeal for admiration. "Miss Hale looks well, ma'am, doesn't she? Mrs. Shaw's coral couldn't have come in better. It just gives the right touch of colour, ma'am. Otherwise, Miss Margaret, you would have been too pale." Margaret's black hair was too thick to be plaited. It needed rather to be twisted round and round, and have its fine silkiness compressed into massive coils that encircled her head like a crown, and then were gathered into a large spiral knot behind. She kept its weight together by two large coral pins, like small arrows, for length. Her white silk sleeves were looped up with strings of the same material, and on her neck, just below the base of her curved and milk-white throat, there lay heavy coral beads. "Oh, Margaret, how I should like to be going with you to one of the old Barrington assemblies, taking you as Lady Beresford used to take me." Margaret kissed her mother for this little burst of maternal vanity, but she could hardly smile at it, she felt so much out of spirits. "I would rather stay at home with you, much rather, Mama." "Nonsense, darling. Be sure you notice the dinner well. I shall like to hear how they manage these things in Milton, particularly the second course, dear. Look what they have instead of game." Mrs. Hale would have been more than interested. She would have been astonished if she had seen the sumptuousness of the dinner table and its appointments. Margaret, with her London cultivated taste, felt the number of delicacies to be oppressive. One half of the quantity would have been enough, and the effect lighter and more elegant. But it was one of Mrs. Thornton's rigorous laws of hospitality that of each separate dainty enough should be provided for all the guests to partake, if they felt inclined. Careless to abstemiousness in her daily habits, it was part of her pride to set a feast before such of her guests as cared for it. Her son shared this feeling. He had never known, though he might have imagined, and had the capability to relish, any kind of society but that which depended on an exchange of superb meals, and even now, though he was denying himself the personal expenditure of an unnecessary sixpence, and had more than once regretted that the invitations for this dinner had been sent out, still, as it was to be, he was glad to see the old magnificence of preparation. Margaret and her father were the first to arrive. Mr. Hill was anxiously punctual to the time specified. There was no one upstairs in the drawing-room but Mrs. Thornton and Fanny. Every cover was taken off, and the apartment blazed forth in yellow silk damask and a brilliantly flowered carpet. Every corner seemed filled up with ornament, until it became a weariness to the eye, and presented a strange contrast to the bald ugliness of the lookout into the great mill yard, where wide folding gates were thrown open for the admission of carriages. The mill loomed high on the left-hand side of the windows, casting a shadow down from its many stories, which darkened the summer evening before its time. "My son was engaged up to the last moment on business. He will be here directly, Mr. Hale. May I beg you to take a seat?" Mr. Hale was standing at one of the windows as Mrs. Thornton spoke. He turned away, saying, "Don't you find such close neighbourhood to the mill rather unpleasant at times?" She drew herself up. "Never. I am not become so fine as to desire to forget the source of my son's wealth and power. Besides, there is not such another factory in Milton. One room alone is 220 square yards. I meant that the smoke and the noise, the constant going out and coming in of the workpeople, might be annoying."
"I agree with you, Mr. Hale," said Fanny. "There is a continual smell of steam and oily machinery, and the noise is perfectly deafening."
"I have heard noise that was called music far more deafening. The engine room is at the street end of the factory. We hardly hear it, except in summer weather, when all the windows are open, and as for the continual murmur of the workpeople, it disturbs me no more than the humming of a hive of bees. If I think of it at all, I connect it with my son, and feel how all belongs to him, and that his is the head that directs it. Just now there are no sounds to come from the mill. The hands have been ungrateful enough to turn out, as perhaps you have heard. But the very business, of which I spoke when you entered, had reference to the steps he is going to take to make them learn their place." The expression on her face, always stern, deepened into dark anger as she said this. Nor did it clear away when Mr. Thornton entered the room, for she saw in an instant the weight of care and anxiety which he could not shake off, although his guests received from him a greeting that appeared both cheerful and cordial. He shook hands with Margaret. He knew it was the first time their hands had met, though she was perfectly unconscious of the fact. He inquired after Mrs. Hale, and heard Mr. Hale's sanguine, hopeful account, and glancing at Margaret to understand how far she agreed with her father, he saw that no dissenting shadow crossed her face. And as he looked with this intention, he was struck anew with her great beauty. He had never seen her in such dress before, and yet now it appeared as if such elegance of attire was so befitting her noble figure and lofty serenity of countenance that she ought to go always thus apparelled. She was talking to Fanny, about what he could not hear, but he saw his sister's restless way of continually arranging some part of her gown, her wandering eyes, now glancing here, now there, but without any purpose in her observation. And he contrasted them uneasily with the large soft eyes that looked forth steadily at one object, as if from out their light beamed some gentle influence of repose. The curving lines of the red lips just parted in the interest of listening to what her companion said, the head a little bent forwards so as to make a long sweeping line from the summit, where the light caught on the glossy raven hair, to the smooth ivory tip of the shoulder, the round white arms and taper hands laid lightly across each other, but perfectly motionless in their pretty attitude. Mr. Thornton sighed as he took in all this with one of his sudden comprehensive glances. And then he turned his back to the young ladies and threw himself with an effort, but with all his heart and soul, into a conversation with Mr. Hale. More people came, more and more. Fanny left Margaret's side and helped her mother to receive her guests. Mr. Thornton felt that in this influx no one was speaking to Margaret and was restless under this apparent neglect. But he never went near her himself. He did not look at her. Only he knew what she was doing, or not doing, better than he knew the movements of anyone else in the room. Margaret was so unconscious of herself, and so much amused by watching other people, that she never thought whether she was left unnoticed or not. Somebody took her down to dinner. She did not catch the name, nor did he seem much inclined to talk to her. There was a very animated conversation going on among the gentlemen. The ladies, for the most part, were silent, employing themselves in taking notes at the dinner and criticizing each other's dresses. Margaret caught the clue to the general conversation, grew interested and listened attentively. Mr. Horsfall, the stranger whose visit to the town was the original germ of the party, was asking questions relative to the trade and manufactures of the place. And the rest of the gentlemen, all Milton men, were giving him answers and explanations. Some dispute arose, which was warmly contested. It was referred to Mr. Thornton, who had hardly spoken before, but who now gave an opinion, the grounds of which were so clearly stated that even the opponents yielded. Margaret's attention was thus called to her host. His whole manner as master of the house and entertainer of his friends was so straightforward yet simple and modest as to be thoroughly dignified. Margaret thought she had never seen him to so much advantage. When he had come to their house, there had always been something, either of over-eagerness or of that kind of vexed annoyance which seemed ready to presuppose that he was unjustly judged, and yet felt too proud to try and make himself better understood. But now among his fellows there was no uncertainty as to his position. He was regarded by them as a man of great force of character, of power in many ways. There was no need to struggle for their respect. He had it, and he knew it. And the security of this gave a fine grand quietness to his voice and ways, which Margaret had missed before. He was not in the habit of talking to ladies, and what he did say was a little formal. To Margaret herself, he hardly spoke at all. She was surprised to think how much she enjoyed this dinner. She knew enough now to understand many local interests, nay, even some of the technical words employed by the eager mill-owners. She silently took a very decided part in the question they were discussing. At any rate, they talked in desperate earnest, not in the used-up style that wearied her so in the old London parties. She wondered that with all this dwelling on the manufactures and trade of the place, no allusion was made to the strike then pending. She did not yet know how coolly such things were taken by the masters as having only one possible end. To be sure, the men were cutting their own throats, as they had done many a time before. But if they would be fools and put themselves into the hands of a rascally set of paid delegates, they must take the consequence. One or two thought Thornton looked out of spirits, and, of course, he must lose by this turnout. But it was an accident that might happen to themselves any day, and Thornton was as good to manage a strike as anyone, for he was as iron a chap as any in Milton. The hands had mistaken their man in trying that dodge on him, and they chuckled inwardly at the idea of the workmen's discomfiture and defeat in their attempt to alter one iota of what Thornton had decreed. It was rather dull for Margaret after dinner. She was glad when the gentleman came, not merely because she caught her father's eye to brighten her sleepiness up, but because she could listen to something larger and grander than the petty interests which the ladies had been talking about. She liked the exultation and the sense of power which these Milton men had. It might be rather rampant in its display and savour of boasting, but still they seemed to defy the old limits of possibility in a kind of fine intoxication caused by the recollection of what had been achieved and what yet should be. If in her cooler moments she might not approve of their spirit in all things, still there was much to admire in their forgetfulness of themselves and the present, in their anticipated triumphs over all inanimate matter at some future time which none of them should live to see. She was rather startled when Mr. Thornton spoke to her close at her elbow. "I could see you were on our side in our discussion at dinner, were you not, Miss Hale?"
"Certainly, but then I know so little about it. I was surprised, however, to find from what Mr. Horsfall said that there were others who thought in so diametrically opposite a manner. As the Mr. Morrison he spoke about, he cannot be a gentleman, is he?"
"I am not quite the person to decide on another's gentlemanliness, Miss Hale. I mean, I don't quite understand your application of the word. But I should say that this Morrison is no true man. I don't know who he is. I merely judge him from Mr. Horsfall's account."
"I suspect my gentleman includes your true man."
"And a great deal more, you would imply.
I differ from you.
A man is to me a higher and a completer being than a gentleman."
"What do you mean?"
asked Margaret. "We must understand the words differently." "I take it that gentleman is a term that only describes a person in his relation to others. But when we speak of him as a man, we consider him not merely with regard to his fellow men, but in relation to himself, to life, to time, to eternity. A castaway, lonely as Robinson Crusoe, a prisoner immured in a dungeon for life, nay, even a saint in Patmos has his endurance, his strength, his faith, best described by being spoken of as a man. I am rather weary of this word gentlemanly, which seems to me to be often inappropriately used, and often too with such exaggerated distortion of meaning, while the full simplicity of the noun man and the adjective manly are unacknowledged, that I am induced to class it with the cant of the day. Margaret thought a moment, but before she could speak her slow conviction, he was called away by some of the eager manufacturers, whose speeches she could not hear, though she could guess at their import by the short, clear answers Mr. Thornton gave, which came steady and firm as the boom of a distant minute gun. They were evidently talking of the turnout, and suggesting what course had best be pursued. She heard Mr. Thornton say, "That has been done." Then came a hurried murmur, in which two or three joined. "All those arrangements have been made." Some doubts were implied, some difficulties named by Mr. Slickson, who took hold of Mr. Thornton's arm, the better to impress his words. Mr. Thornton moved slightly away, lifted his eyebrows a very little, and then replied, "I take the risk. You need not join in it unless you choose." Still some more fears were urged. "I'm not afraid of anything so dastardly as incendiarism. We are open enemies, and I can protect myself from any violence but I apprehend. And I will assuredly protect all others who come to me for work. They know my determination by this time as well and as fully as you do." Mr. Horsfall took him a little on one side, as Margaret conjectured, to ask him some other question about the strike. But in truth, it was to inquire who she herself was, so quiet, so stately, and so beautiful. "A Milton lady?" asked he, as the name was given. "No, from the south of England. Hampshire, I believe," was the cold, indifferent answer. Mrs. Slickson was catechizing Fanny on the same subject. "Who is that fine, distinguished-looking girl? A sister of Mr. Horsfall's?"
"Oh, dear, no. That is Mr. Hale, her father, talking now to Mr. Stevens. He gives lessons. That is to say, he reads with young men. My brother John goes to him twice a week, and so he begged Mama to ask him here, in hopes of getting him known. I believe we have some of their prospectuses, if you would like to have one." "Mr. Thornton, does he really find time to read with a tutor in the midst of all his business, and this abominable strike in hand as well?" Fanny was not sure, from Mrs. Slickson's manner, whether she ought to be proud or ashamed of her brother's conduct. And like all people who try and take other people's ought for the rule of their feelings, she was inclined to blush for any singularity of action. Her shame was interrupted by the dispersion of the guests. Chapter 21 The Dark Night. On earth is known to none the smile that is not sister to a tear. Eliot. Margaret and her father walked home. The night was fine, the streets clean, and with her pretty white silk, like Lizzie Lindsay's gown of green satin in the ballad, kilted up to her knee, she was off with her father, ready to dance along with the excitement of the cool, fresh night air. "I rather think Thornton is not quite easy in his mind about this strike. He seemed very anxious tonight." "I should wonder if he were not, but he spoke with his usual coolness to the others when they suggested different things just before we came away."
"So he did after dinner as well. It would take a good deal to stir him from his cool manner of speaking, but his face strikes me as anxious."
"I should be if I were he. He must know of the growing anger and hardly smothered hatred of his workpeople, who all look upon him as what the Bible calls a hard man. Not so much unjust as unfeeling. Clear in judgment, standing upon his rights as no human being ought to stand, considering what we and all our petty rights are in the sight of the Almighty. I am glad you think he looks anxious. When I remember Boucher's half-mad words and ways, I cannot bear to think how coolly Mr. Thornton spoke.
In the first place, I'm not so convinced as you are about that man Boucher's utter distress. For the moment he was badly off, I don't doubt, but there is always a mysterious supply of money from these unions, and from what you said, it was evident the man was of a passionate demonstrative nature, and gave strong expression to all he felt.
Oh, Papa!
Well, I only want you to do justice to Mr. Thornton, who is, I suspect, of an exactly opposite nature. A man who is far too proud to show his feelings. Just the character I should have thought beforehand you would have admired, Margaret.
So I do. So I should. But I don't feel quite so sure as you do of the existence of those feelings. He is a man of great strength of character, of unusual intellect, considering the few advantages he has had.
Not so few. He has led a practical life from a very early age, has been called upon to exercise judgment and self-control. All that develops one part of the intellect. To be sure, he needs some of the knowledge of the past, which gives the truest basis for conjecture as to the future. But he knows this need. He perceives it, and that is something. You are quite prejudiced against Mr. Thornton, Margaret.
He is the first specimen of a manufacturer, of a person engaged in trade, that I have ever the opportunity of studying, Papa. He is my first olive. Let me make a face while I swallow it. I know he is good of his kind, and by I shall like the kind. I rather think I am already beginning to do so. I was very much interested by what the gentlemen were talking about, although I did not understand half of it. I was quite sorry when Miss Thornton came to take me to the other end of the room, saying she was sure I should be uncomfortable at being the only lady among so many gentlemen. I had never thought about it. I was so busy listening. And the ladies were so dull, Papa. Oh, so dull. Yet I think it was clever, too. It reminded me of our old game of having each so many nouns to introduce into a sentence.
"What do you mean, child?" asked Mr. Hale.
"Why, they took nouns that were signs of things which gave evidence of wealth. Housekeepers, undergardeners, extent of glass, valuable lace, diamonds, and all such things, and each one formed her speech so as to bring them all in the prettiest accidental manner possible.
You will be as proud of your one servant when you get her, if all is true about her that Mrs. Thornton says."
"To be sure I shall. I felt like a great hypocrite tonight, sitting there in my white silk gown, with my idle hands before me, when I remembered all the good, thorough housework they had done today. They took me for a fine lady, I'm sure."
"Even I was mistaken enough to think you looked like a lady, my dear," said Mr. Hale, quietly smiling.
But smiles were changed to white and trembling looks when they saw Dixon's face as she opened the door.
"Oh, Master! Oh, Miss Margaret! Thank God you are come! Dr. Donaldson is here. The servant next door went for him, for the charwoman is gone home. She's better now. But, oh, sir, I thought she'd have died an hour ago."
Mr. Hale caught Margaret's arm to steady himself from falling. He looked at her face and saw an expression upon it of surprise and extremest sorrow, but not the agony of terror that contracted his own unprepared heart. She knew more than he did, and yet she listened with that hopeless expression of awed apprehension.
"Oh, I should not have left her, wicked daughter that I am," moaned forth Margaret as she supported her trembling father's hasty steps upstairs. Dr. Donaldson met them on the landing.
"She is better now," he whispered. "The opiate has taken effect. The spasms were very bad. No wonder they frightened your maid, but she'll rally this time."
"This time, let me go to her."
Half an hour ago, Mr. Hale was a middle-aged man. Now his sight was dim, his senses wavering, his walk tottering, as if he were 70 years of age. Dr. Donaldson took his arm and led him into the bedroom. Margaret followed close. There lay her mother, with an unmistakable look on her face. She might be better now. She was sleeping. But death had signed her for his own, and it was clear that ere long he would return to take possession. Mr. Hale looked at her for some time without a word.
Then he began to shake all over, and turning away from Dr. Donaldson's anxious care, he groped to find the door. He could not see it, although several candles, brought in the sudden affright, were burning and flaring there. He staggered into the drawing room and felt about for a chair. Dr. Donaldson wheeled one to him and placed him in it. He felt his pulse. "Speak to him, Miss Hale. We must rouse him."
"Papa,"
said Margaret, with the crying